So I guess I'd like to start out by saying that I've been doing this stuff for 30 years now, you know, sort of working as an active physicist, and this is far and away the most exciting period of time that I've been involved with. This transparency tells the whole story. It turns out that in the high temperature superconductors, the pairing is fundamentally different than in the low temperature superconductors, and one can take advantage of this difference to make, in a special geometry, you can make the superconductor spontaneously generate a vortex which has exactly half of the flux, total flux, of the flux quantum we've been talking about. One can take advantage of this effect to test the way that the pairs form, and one can demonstrate that the pairs form in a particular symmetry. Most of what I'll be talking about is on the website here. It's at research.ibm.com, and then it's just half vortex. And the work was done with Chang Tsui, Catherine Moeller, George Trafas, who did the who actually made the samples. And Chang, of course, was the one who thought of this experiment in the first place. And then Mark Ketchum, Monjul Bokshan, and Art Ellis helped to build this microscope. So a lot of what I'll say, it will be a repeat of earlier talks, but essentially superconductivity happens when the charge carriers, either electrons or the absence of electrons, holes, undergo Cooper pairing. So as Laura said, essentially the idea is that one charge carrier goes through the solid, it deforms the solid, and then the second charge carrier goes through and it sees that deformation. And that's how the pairing happens. In conventional superconductors, the elemental superconductors that Doug was talking about, it's very well established that the thing that is causing the pairing is a lattice deformation, just a motion of the atoms. In the high temperature superconductors, we just don't know. Or everybody knows, but they can't agree on it. In analogy with the hydrogen atom, I'd like to talk about the symmetry that we're talking about. In the hydrogen atom, you have a proton, you have an electron. This electron, in some sense, is orbiting around the proton. But that's not a real good picture of things. What's really going on is that the electron is described by a function, a wave function, and the laws of quantum mechanics only allow certain shapes for this wave function. In the hydrogen atom, you can have an S shape, a symmetric shape. You can have a P shape, which has lobes. In space, which are either pointing up or pointing down, or you can have a V shape, or higher angular momentum states. Similarly, in the superconductors, instead of having a proton with an electron traveling around it, the actual Cooper pairs have a wave function that describes them. And the question that you can ask is, if I know where one of the electrons is, where am I likely to find the other one? And again, you can have characteristic shapes. You can have an S shape, a symmetric shape, or you can have a D shape, or you can have a G shape. Most experiments measure the wave function amplitude. And the question that you're allowed to ask is, where am I likely to find this electron? And that question is answered by the square of that amplitude. These experiments I'd like to tell you about actually or at least an indication of the phase of the wave function. And the debate about this, the shape of the wave function, has sort of settled down, or did settle down, into S, or anisotropic S, or D, or extended S wave, different shapes. The major difference, say, an anisotropic S shape and a D shape, is the D shape actually has a sign change. So you have a wave function which has an amplitude, but it also has a phase. And in this function, this lobe here is pi out of phase. With this, it has the same amplitude. It's multiplied by its sign. Our experiments, this class of experiments I'm going to tell you about, can actually tell about that sign change. Okay, the way we do that is by taking two concepts which Alora and Doug have talked about. The first concept is called Josephson tunneling. And essentially the idea is that if you take two superconductors and put them very close together, then it's possible for a Cooper pair to disappear from one side and miraculously appear on the other side. Even more amazing than this tunneling through the forbidden region is that they remember their phase after transferring across the insulator. And in fact, Josephson wrote down the equation that says that the amount of supercurrent, the amount of transfer of Cooper pairs that get across this forbidden region, goes like some number times the sine of the phase difference across the insulator. One more thing that's necessary for these experiments to work is that the Cooper pairs are most likely to get across their impinging on the surface, normal to the surface. So you're actually sensing the direction dependence of the phase of the Cooper pair. Okay, the other concept that these experiments depend on is flux quantization, which Doug told you about. And by analogy then with something which you may be familiar with, if you have a particle which is described by a wave function, and you stick it in a box, and the edges of the box are such that the wave function has to be zero, then there are only certain allowed states that this particle can have. It can have one wiggle in the wave, or it can have two wiggles in the wave, or it can have three wiggles in the wave, but it can't have some odd fraction of number of wiggles. And what this leads to is a ladder of allowed energy states. And this in fact leads to the filling of the box that Laura was telling me about. A superconducting ring, by analogy, if you think of a ring that's superconducting, it has also a function that describes its properties. In the lowest state, the ground state of this ring, the function is very boring. It's just a constant as you go around. But as Doug described, if you start running current around this ring, the current is closely related to the phase, and the ring can only have certain quantized amounts of total magnetic field in the ring. And the flux in the ring, the total integrated field, is some number times the flux quantum. See, I can use Doug's thing to indicate something that's really cool when you have an unconventional superconductor. So we've talked about this function which describes the pairing of the states. And we've talked about it as a function, sort of a macroscopic function. But it turns out that the function knows about what's going on sort of macroscopically, and it also knows about what's going on inside the pairs. Imagine, for an example, that you had a superconductor in which the pairing was P-wave. This is the simplest thing to think about. A P-wave superconductor has a positive lobe and a negative lobe, and one is pointing in one direction in space, the other is pointing in the opposite direction in space. Imagine that you have a crystal that has this this kind of pairing, and imagine, as Doug has told you, if you run a current through this bar of superconductor, it causes a twist in the phase. Now imagine that you can make a ring of this stuff with a Josephson, with one of these weak links built into it. And I've sort of done this. These are P-wave for pairs. And what happens is that if they're all pointing in the same direction, you have a positive part of the wave here, the internal wave, pointing at a negative part of the internal wave there. This costs Josephson energy. Josephson doesn't like this to happen. And nature always tries to find a way to get to the lowest energy. The way it does that is by, it wants this phase and this phase to match up. What it does, just like Doug was talking about, is it twists the wave function as you go around. It's sort of a chicken and an egg sort of thing. Either the twist of the wave function causes current to go around, or the current going around causes a twist in the wave function. But either way you like to think about it, this spontaneously generates current around this ring. And the truly remarkable thing is that the spontaneously generated current is just large enough to give you exactly half of a flux quantum in this ring. Okay, so this sounds fairly esoteric. How do I know that? And I must say there was a great deal of work that went before ours that indicates that this is happening. But pictures are always nice. Anyway, Chang Tsui came up with a way of making one of these frustrated rings. I don't want to go into great details. Let me just say that it's possible to grow these materials, which are layered, which is lost now, on top of a crystal which has very much the same atomic structure. If you grow them on top of one of these materials, the atoms like to line up in convenient places, and they just grow. It's called epitaxially. They have the same atomic structure. If you make a crystal that has essentially it's a frustrated geometry out of strontium titanate, which is just an insulator, but you can make these cuprates, these high TC superconductors, frustrated also. Since these things are D-wave superconductors rather than P-wave superconductors, the geometry that you have to make it frustrated is more complicated. But it turns out that if you take three of these crystals, then you can make a frustrated geometry. And you can sort of see it by drawing these four-leaf clovers, that there's actually a sign change between the wave functions normal to the interface here and there. So this is it's a frustrated geometry, and it's made of Josephson weak links. What Chang did then, after growing this this film on top of the substrate is by lithographic patterning made rings. So they're rings very much like we've been talking about, except they're about 50 microns across. A human hair is about 100 microns across. They're sort of half of a human hair in diameter. Now, how do you tell that these things have entered this half-lux quantum state? You tell that by making a microscope using Mr. Squid, or his equivalent. The difference is that the squid, rather than being a sort of a macroscopic thing, is made by photolithographic patterning, and it has a very small pickup loop. This pickup loop is typically 4 microns across. So again, a human hair is 100 microns, so the pickup loop is about a 20th of a human hair in diameter. You can see with this pickup loop magnetic fields, which are very small, but you can resolve things on about the same level that you can resolve things with an optical microscope. So it's very much like a microscope. So you take a superconducting quantum interference device in this special geometry. I polish the substrate, which is silicon, so that the tip is very close to the pickup loop. And then I mount it so that the pickup loop is very close to the sample. And then to make an image, I just scan the sample relative to the pickup loop. The scanning is amazingly non-sophisticated. So essentially, lever. So imagine that I have the sample mounted at the bottom of this lever. It's at very low temperatures, and it's really hard to make a motor that works at low temperatures. So what you do instead is you have a pivoting point here, and you put your motor up at room temperature. And then you just scan the top of the lever, and then the bottom of the lever goes in the opposite direction. And you actually get some mechanical disadvantage because this length is much longer than that length. Now, this is it works amazingly for a microscope. It's astonishing that it works. I wanted to show, just to give you a flavor of what it is like working in a lab, show some pictures of the microscope. This is in a shielded room. It turns out that these squids are unhappy when they see radio waves. And the way to avoid that is to put it in a conducting shield. So it's in a shielded room. The microscope, again, it's a long lever with the sample down here. The motors that drive it up there, and this goes down into it's a thermos bottle, so it's like you carry your coffee around, but it's filled with liquid helium rather than coffee, and this thermos bottle keeps the liquid helium for about 3 weeks, and that makes life easy. It makes it possible to have a life and be an experimentalist. The Dewar has, it's called mu metal. It's a metal that has a very high magnetic permeability. This excludes magnetic field. So the magnetic field down in the bottom of the Dewar is it's about 1/100th of the field Earth, Earth's magnetic field. This is a blow up of the active region of the microscope. So here's the sample mounted again at the bottom of the long tube. The squid is, if you have good eyes, you can see it. It's that little dot right there. And it's mounted on actually a piece of brass, brass shim that I've polished down to about half a micron thick by hand. And then it's glued to this piece of brass. And then I use a wire bond to make wire bonds. And I like to think that most of my time in the lab is actually very much like when we built model radios when we were kids. This is all built by hand, epoxy and wiring under a microscope. This is about a centimeter from there to there. So, it's really fine stuff, but it's really amazing that IBM pays me to do it. It's fun. This is a blow up of bringing the squid down towards the sample. The sample is optically reflective, so you can see the sample and the squid. This is the image of the squid in the sample. Of course, when I'm running, this tip, which is where the pickup loop is in contact. And of course, I can't see that this when I'm running because it's at the bottom of the doer under 3 feet of liquid helium. I can infer what's happening by looking at the magnetic images and not smash the tip. And then finally, this is not too bad. So this is actually a photograph of the squid itself. So it's made on a silicon substrate. This is about 3 millimeters from there to there. About a millimeter from there to there. And it's made from niobium and aluminum oxide and niobium, which are conventional superconductors, using the same sorts of processes that one uses to make computers. The guts of the squid are here. This is the loop that Doug was telling you about. And you actually can't see them. There are some tunnel junctions there, which are they're about a micron across. And then this is the modulation coil. This leads into, it's actually a superconducting sheath. So the leads are surrounded by superconductor. And what this means from this Meissner screening that Doug was talking about means that only the pickup loop is sensitive to the magnetic fields. And finally, this is the pickup loop here. And again, this one I think is about 7 microns across. So it's about a tenth of a human hair in diameter. Okay, so I take this frustrated geometry from this frustrated room I was telling you about, and I cool it in very low fields, and then I scan this squid relative to it, and this is the image. This is 300 microns from here to here, so about 3 human hairs. And the central ring, obviously something special is going on there. These 3 rings on the outside are control rings. They're designed to be not frustrated. And if what we think is going on, they should show the conventional quantization. And in fact, they have no magnetic flux in them. And the only reason that you can see them at all, it's a garbage effect. The central ring we showed has exactly half of the flux quantum. In order to demonstrate that this really is connected with the symmetry of the pairing, with the shape of the Cooper pairs, what you have to do is change the geometry. And in changing the geometry, you can just turn this effect on and off. Okay. What I'm actually changing is the positions of the rings, the angles of the underlying substrate. Unfortunately, this does not show, but if you draw little four-leaf clovers on here, you have a sign change going from this little crystal to that little crystal, but you don't have a sign change in this geometry going from there to there. Also, to show that this is really connected with the guts of the Cooper pairs, you have to show that it does not depend on the ring shape. So in fact, we've done it in rings, we've done it in disks, and finally, we realized that you don't have to pattern these things at all. If you just take one of these crystals and evaporate condense this high TC superconductor on top of it. The central point is frustrated. It has to generate a half of the vortex at that the central point. I keep on wanting to pick up a view graph and put it on the... Finally, this half vortex has a shape, and the shape was actually... this effect was predicted by Geschenbein, Larkin, and Baroni in the mid-80s. And I like to show this transparency because it really shows how remarkably prescient the theoretical prediction was, that they really knew what was going to happen if you could make the right geometry, and if these things were in fact unconventional superconductors. Okay, finally, you know, one of the barriers to practical applications of these squids is that they have to be cold to work. And there are many ways of getting around it. One is to build a microscope in which you keep the squid cold, but you warm up the sample. And in fact, if you're careful, you can get the sample really pretty warm and take magnetic images with a pretty high spatial resolution. Again, this was, it's absolutely amazing that this worked. It was, but what you do is you take a squid, you and you make just a very tight thermal contact between the liquid helium, which is surrounding this microscope, and the squid, and then you heat up the sample. Do that, you can actually image, visualize the spontaneous nature of the flux generation in this sample. So this is these are magnetic images taken with the squid. Of the sample, the central point, the frustrated point of the sample as a function of temperature. When you're above the superconducting transition, which is about 90 Kelvin, 89 Kelvin, in the sample, you just see nothing. The image is just completely magnetically flat. As soon as you go below the superconducting transition, this thing spontaneously generates. It's fat at first, but then it just gets skinnier and skinnier and skinnier until at low temperatures. I've put up a diagram of the pickup loop, and you can see that actually at low temperatures, the vortex looks like the pickup loop, has the same shape. And the reason for that is that the vortex has gotten much smaller than the pickup loop. So you're actually imaging the pickup loop in some sense, rather than the vortex. An amusing thing is that you can see that this image is relatively noisy. And the reason for that is that I have, for the squid, it's a very hot sample. And the squid, just as soon as I run with the squid about a micron above the sample. If I bring the squid down by accident, so that it's actually touching the sample, then it goes nuts, and actually it goes normal and loses its flux locking and everything. Here it's just barely brushing the sample, and so while it touches and goes nuts, and then it comes back, and that's what this noise is in the image. And I think that's the end. Doing fine for time, I guess. So, these superconductors have they've thought of a new way of pairing. This pairing generates sign changes in the pairing wave function, and we can build a geometry that takes advantage of these sign changes to produce a flux quantum, which is half of that normally seen. We've seen this in every high-TC superconductor we've looked at. I don't think this has been mentioned, but there are many different compounds which have essentially the same idea, but are made with different constituents. And everyone we've looked at shows this unusual pairing. And finally, if you look at the temperature dependence of this thing, it happens at all temperatures. It spontaneously generates, as near as we can tell, instantaneously. As soon as the thing goes superconductor, it has exactly the same amount of flux at all temperatures. And this implies that the D pairing happens at all temperatures. Thank you.